everybody. Thank you so much for this opportunity. Really a pleasure to be here. So knowing that we have somewhere between 45 and 60 minutes, I'm going to try my best to get through the material that I've prepared. Really my goal for this morning is to provide each and every one of us with an overview and nothing more than that. We're going to be talking about a lot of different issues, and each and every one of these issues are complicated and complex and deserve really, in their own right, a lengthy discussion. But the goal over here is just to sort of create an appreciation of the framework in which we understand and can appreciate the intersection between mental illness in a general sense, although we'll talk about some specific cases in a moment, and Torah. And hopefully by doing so, we will, number one, raise some awareness for those in the room who perhaps in terms of their own experiences with yourself, members of your family, friends, colleagues, who may be having struggles of different nature, may be more informed and therefore be able to give guidance. And I just think in general, it is important for people to understand and to appreciate the extent to which halacha is able to inform and guide and inspire and give chizuk, honestly, in many, many areas in life beyond the sort of the most obvious ones. I'm actually going to shut this light over here because I think it'll be a little easier to see this light.
That works.
Yeah, the sheets that have been handed out are the slides. So if you want, you're welcome to use the sheets, but you can also just sort of look up here and take notes or anything like that. But anything we don't get to, you'll be able to cover. So I wanted to just begin this conversation by just covering very, very briefly some of the common mental disorders. This is not, I have no clinical experience. I am not a physician. I'm not a psychotherapist. So what I'm providing to you right now is not any clinical advice or guidance or anything like that. But I think for many of us, when we hear mental illness, we don't necessarily know, what that means and what is included in that very, very broad category. So you may or may not be surprised to know that there are actually many, many different types and sort of categories and subcategories of mental illness. We do not have the time right now to go through all of them, but just understand and appreciate, why did that happen? It looks like maybe I
zoomed that in too much. Hold on 1 second. Okay.
So we have the first category over here is anxiety disorders. There are people who struggle with different types of anxieties, which come in the form of phobias, which of course means a fear. There are people who just have a general anxiety disorder, which means that they can be anxious on a regular basis, not because of any particular concern or worry that they have, but it interferes with their ability to function normally. There are people who unfortunately suffer from panic attacks that can happen on a frequent or an infrequent basis, which can be very frightening and very debilitating. There is, of course, a fairly well-known disorder known as OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. We're actually going to speak about that a little more later on as we see the way the halacha guides and advises an individual who struggles with an obsessive compulsive disorder, and we're going to actually define it more clearly a little later. And finally, in the general category of anxiety disorders, there is something which is called post-traumatic stress disorder, also sometimes known by the Rashi Tevos, PTSD, which basically is what a person unfortunately experiences sometimes over the course of their lives if it is not treated and there is not appropriate intervention. If a person experiences a trauma, even at a very young age, it can continue to affect them in a very, very significant way over the course of their life. The next sort of general category of mental disorders are known as mood disorders, and this is where a person, unfortunately, is not able to regulate their mood in a way that moods are typically regulated without any real conscious input. So you could have a person who suffers from major depressive disorder, which is also sometimes just known as clinical depression, bipolar disorder, in which the mood fluctuates sometimes very in a very erratic way, going from a very depressive state to a manic state. There are psychotic disorders, which include, of course, schizophrenia and delusional disorders. There are personality disorders, paranoid personality, antisocial personality, borderline personality disorder, narcissistic personality. Of course, again, we are not really going through all these, although for those who are interested, there is more information on the slides. But just that we can understand and appreciate that unlike, for example, you speak about a person who has, let's say, the common cold. So we understand, we basically all know what the features, what the symptoms, and you know what the treatment, if you will, is for a common cold. And that's something that I think all of us can understand and appreciate. It's probably why it's called the common cold. When it comes to mental illness, for those who have not really experienced either personally or do not have the experience indirectly to understand and to appreciate the complexity, the range of different disorders. Of course, we are grouping together right now disorders that have varying degrees of severity. Needless to say, a person who struggles from a general anxiety disorder, which is fairly common and relatively easy to treat, is very different than a person who has schizophrenia. So, but for the purpose of this discussion, and we are going to be talking about sort of the intersection and the way in which the halacha deals and addresses these issues, it is important to recognize that mental illness, in its broadest sense, is actually a very, very complex and wide range set of issues. When we think about halacha in general, and the text which we go to receive halachic guidance and to know exactly how to navigate the different challenges and questions that we experience throughout our life, so we know that we have some familiar halachic texts, which of course include the Shulchan Aruch and Poskim that comment on the Shulchan Aruch, not to mention the myriad of Shas HaTshuvos that have been published over the course of many, many centuries. And I think most of us, I would assume, could in our mind right now put together sort of a list, sort of a typical list of the common areas in which people have halachic questions that are looking for halachic direction. And I imagine that many of us could even more or less intuitively, or maybe because of our own experience and our learning, could figure out where approximately in Shulchan Aruch we can find guidance and direction as to how to deal with different issues. So if I would say, you know, Hilchos Brachos, which of course is a very common area in which people hopefully have from time to time halachic shailas, where to make a bracha, when to make a bracha, what bracha to make. So I would probably know more or less where I can find that. That doesn't mean that necessarily I'll find the answer exactly that I'm looking for, foolish explicitly in Shulchan Aruch, but I'll know the same is true when it comes to Hilchos Tefillah, and the same is true when it comes to Hilchos Tefillah, and Shabbos, and Kashrus, and Tefillos Kelim, and Taras HaMishpacha, and Refuah, and Avelus, Nisuin, Chinuch, Rosh Mishpat. These are many, many fairly common areas in which people who are observant Jews have questions and shailas, and they know more or less where to look, and hopefully on a regular basis are consulting with responsible halachic poskim authorities who can help guide and advise us through the very difficult challenges that we face in life. But if I would ask you, where in Shulchan Aruch, where in sort of the classic halacha svarim would I look if I had shailas about mental illness? What do I mean about shailas about mental illness? I'm actually going to give you some examples in a moment. So what would you tell me? Am I going to find it in Or HaChaim, Yodea, and Ezra, Chosh Mishpah? We're going to find it. And more specifically, yes?
Refuah,
you listen to the okay, so Refuah, correct. So where would I find anything having to do with Hilchos Refuah? So, there are, you know, Refuah in its broadest sense, actually, there's actually a phenomenal work on Refuah in general called Nishmas Avram, and actually has comments on every chelik of Shulchan Aruch, Or HaChaim, Yodea, and Ezra, and Chosh Mishpah, because the truth of the matter is, there are many areas of halacha which can intersect, you know, with the general question of refuah. I appreciate the fact that you are pointing out that we shouldn't necessarily separate mental illness from refuah in general, because it really is an illness. And time doesn't allow, but if I did, I would spend a lot of time talking about why it is that unfortunately we all too often make that mistake, and we are sometimes a lot more sensitive and responsive to people who have physical illnesses and don't appreciate and don't respond in a similar way with dealing with mental illness, when the fact of the matter is there really is no reason to differentiate between the two. Most often a mental illness, not always, but more often than not, is a matter primarily of biochemistry, no different in fact than really any other you know physical illness that a person would suffer from. So the answer to where I would find in Shulchan Aruch, the answer is it's not clear. But what I would like to do for the next few minutes is give you a sense as to the sort of shailas that people ask. And I'm doing so because I want to begin this conversation by sensitizing everybody, if you're not already sufficiently sensitized to this issue, as to the fact that there are, of course, many people, observant Jews, who struggle and suffer from different forms of mental illness and have some very, very serious shailas, again, both in terms of their own mental health and halacha, and sometimes both. And for a person who does not have these struggles and experiences, would never imagine that these types of shailas come up. What we're not going to do right now, partially because time doesn't allow, and also because every situation is complex, and I don't know that it's appropriate in this forum to go ahead and break every one of these shailas down, we're not going to actually go ahead and answer these questions, but I'm going to give you a sample of questions that I have personally received. Now, I'm not a posek, and as I mentioned already, I'm not a psychotherapist, so these shailas are shailas that, of course, I would consult with people who are qualified to inform and to guide and to paskin, both as far as the halacha, as in addition to what's appropriate for one's mental health care and management. But I do think it's important to understand and realize that these are real questions. I have changed, of course, the names and the circumstances, so there's nothing over here that would be obvious to anybody as to, you know, who I'm talking about. But these are actual shailas. And I just want, again, that we should sort of appreciate the potential clash and conflicts. Elizabeth, 38, has struggled for many years with an eating disorder. After years of treatment, she has successfully refrained from restricted eating for close to 1 year, which means that for an entire year she has been eating, we'll say, normally. Her therapist warned that fasting, even for 1 day, could potentially trigger a relapse. What should she do on Yom Kippur? Now, I don't have to tell you, I'm sure that everybody understands and appreciates, that Yom Kippur is unique, certainly in comparison to all the other fast days. First of all, the requirement to fast is Minat Torah. The prohibition, the issue of eating on Yom Kippur, is something which is very serious. For a person to eat on Yom Kippur, certainly, you know, b'mezid, we're dealing with something, it's Isser Karis. It's a very, very, very serious prohibition. And I think that for somebody who was not necessarily sensitized and attuned and aware as to what can sometimes happen when a person has an eating disorder, may look at the shaila and say, there's nothing to discuss. This person has been basically eating normally for a year, assuming, of course, that this person has now, you know, regained their strength, they're sufficiently nourished, appropriate weight. So there really shouldn't be much of a shaila. Of course, this person has to fast, right? And even though I said I'm not going to answer the question, the answer is not so pashut at all. Every situation is different, but I will tell you my experience, more often than not, the answer is no. Now why, and of course it's going to depend on the circumstances, not for now, but just to understand and to appreciate that the halacha is responsive and obviously and aware and recognizes and accommodates some of the very real struggles that people have. Yes?
Wouldn't an eating disorder be considered partially cholish yesh b'sakana?
Absolutely. And I appreciate the fact that that's something which is obvious to you. But I want you to know that it's not obvious to everyone. And the answer is potentially, yes. Paul, 52, likely suffers from bipolar disorder, although he has never been formally diagnosed, as he refuses to seek counseling or treatment. As a result, the members of his family tirelessly struggle to maintain peace and stability within their home. Paul's oldest daughter, Jennifer, recently got married, and her husband has been encouraging her to distance herself from her father. He insists that her relationship with her father is stifling her and prevents her from achieving personal happiness and stability in her other relationships. She has come to accept that ending all communication with her father would be in her best interest and inquires if this is indeed permissible. Obviously, this is a very painful shaila, just on a personal level. The thought of ever advising a daughter to essentially sever ties with a parent is something which should make all of us just, you know, stop for a moment and sigh with sadness and frustration. At the same time, I think that such a shaila is not intuitively obvious to everybody. What should be done? So the answer is, again, these situations are complex. But the fact of the matter is, for a person who is on the one hand aware, and in this case dealing indirectly with sort of the effects of the mental illness of another person, is also aware of her halachic obligations in terms of the proper respect and relationship that a person should try to maintain with a parent. And over here, when you have a clash between the two, this is a shaila. Esther, 15, suffers from anorexia and is currently undergoing inpatient treatment. In an effort to optimize treatment, all meals are prepared on site by the trained staff, and no outside food may be brought into the facility, which is typical of most inpatient facilities. May Esther eat non-kosher food as part of her treatment? If she refuses to eat non-kosher food, may her family lie to her and tell her that the food is kosher? Now, since it was already mentioned, I didn't mention this, but very often an eating disorder is something that could certainly qualify as a cholesh yesh bo sakana. In fact, I would say that if somebody's receiving inpatient treatment, it certainly is. Not everybody who suffers from an eating disorder has been hospitalized. But a person has been hospitalized, and that treatment is pretty intensive, and in order to qualify just for, you know, for insurance coverage, for inpatient treatment, you would have to meet that threshold that certainly on Pialacha would be considered a Chol Shebish Pasukana. This would seem to be like an easy question to answer. Of course, a person, if necessary, can eat non-kosher food. But you'll have to take my word for it if you doubt what I'm about to tell you, and that is, I've had conversations with many, many people who don't even ask the shaila because they assume it's not an option. I can't send this person to a hospital if that means they're going to have to eat non-kosher food. So what may be obvious to some of us sitting here is not obvious to many people, and it's important, therefore, to have this conversation. May other members of our family eat the food. That seems a little strange, right? So this is a shaila, believe it or not, you can't even make this up. And I once got, there was a situation where a teenage girl had been in a facility for several months and had been eating the food, and her parents told her that the food was kosher. As part of her recovery, it is necessary, as they sort of try to wean a person to bring them to the next level of treatment so she can now, you know, resume some sort of normal living outside, she has to have supervised meals together with members of her family. So her family was now in a situation where they were coming into this place, and in order to sort of keep, keep this lie going, so they would have to sort of sit down and eat with her whatever was being served. Again, the answer is less relevant for the moment, to just understand and to appreciate the sort of situations that people can find themselves in. Adam, 16, suffers from bipolar disorder and has been placed in a treatment facility in Utah. That's not random, by the way. Many of the treatment facilities for people who struggle from mental illness happen to be in places like Utah for a whole variety of reasons. But, you know, there and actually the pictures over there give some of it away. I mean, the environment, there are several reasons why Utah is actually a state which has many centers of this type. But part of it is just the area in which people are able to go and to sort of rebuild themselves in an area which is very wholesome and nurturing, and in some ways less stifling than the area where they come from. Direct contact with family is limited to highly supervised, specialized, structured visiting days, which take place approximately every 6 weeks. Visiting day has been scheduled for Friday and Saturday. May Adam and his parents join the rest of the group and participate in the activities, which would certainly interfere with their ability to properly observe Shabbos. So the shortest shilas that I've received are people who are basically, they're going to go out there once every 6 weeks, spend the day with their child, and they're going to take them on a bus, and they're going to go to the middle of the desert somewhere and maybe do like rappelling, or they'll do some outdoor activities. Certainly, we're not talking about, you know, sitting inside, you know, some sort of visiting room and playing chess. We're talking about the types of things that nobody would ever think or want to do on Shabbos. Is this permissible? Josh, 13, has recently become a bar mitzvah and has been wearing tefillin for the first time. He suffers from severe OCD and an acute anxiety disorder, due to which he finds it exceedingly distressing to come in contact with leather. The experience of wearing tefillin triggers an avalanche of emotions that bring him to the verge of tears and sometimes beyond. Should he be required and encouraged to wear tefillin? This shaila I've only had once, and this is way before I was even qualified to think for a second that I can perhaps address a shaila like this. But I remember the shaila about 20 years ago, and remember having this chus to discuss it with Rav Schechter. So this, you know, again, you may be tempted or may not, you know, to just want to know answers. But the goal at this point, the exercise at this point in our discussion, is just to appreciate the very real and painful and difficult challenges that people have to deal with. Stephen, 45, has ever... Yes?
Can't the wearing of the tefillin be incorporated to the framework of the OCD therapy?
Possibly. That's assuming that he's a candidate for therapy. He was a 13-year-old boy. He was a bar mitzvah boy. So not every 13-year-old is ready and available and willing to participate in that therapy. And it may be weeks or months before they can get to that point. But the answer is yeah. I mean, ultimately, that may be the case. For him, I think it was actually, this particular kid, it was more than OCD. He had a very, very, there was a very, very strong ideological, issue that he had, and he didn't wear leather belts either, and I don't think it was an OCD issue. Okay, but Stephen, 45, there's a very common shaila. Is a recovering alcoholic and has not had an alcoholic drink for over 1 year. May or should the members of his family refrain from drinking wine at the Pesach Seder in an effort to protect Stephen from potentially harmful exposure to alcohol? Now, you could ask the same question about Shabbos and Purim, but it's a little less pressing there for reasons that may not be obvious. So, you know, so the shaila over here is not, can a recovering alcoholic or should a recovering alcoholic drink dalakosos from wine? I mean, that's not even a shaila. But, and by the way, it doesn't make a difference whether it's recovering for a year or 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 or 50. That doesn't make a difference. That doesn't change. But what about the other members of the family? Yes?
Grape juice
may potentially also be an issue. You're saying that's an option, you're saying?
Yeah.
Oh, Okay. For some who, you know, will drink. Again, I'm not saying that the answers over here are even necessarily so difficult or that the solutions are so difficult, but to understand and to appreciate, you know, over here, imagine a Seder, we have 20, 30, 40 people around, sitting around the table. There's one person over here, perhaps nobody, not everybody even knows the struggles that this individual has. So what, you know, what impact, if any, does his experience have on everybody else around the table? It's a little more complex than, you know, is grape juice an option for Dalicosa? Tammy, 38, has three children and has had two serious bouts of postpartum depression. With extensive therapy and medication, she has successfully brought her depression under control, but has been advised to use contraception to avert future pregnancies. Despite the proper use of birth control, she discovers that she is pregnant and is suddenly overwhelmed with a wave of shock, fear, and extreme panic. Fearing that another pregnancy may trigger another bout of depression, she seeks a heter to proceed with an abortion. Very, very serious, Shiloh. Susan, 43, suffers from depression, and although she has never attempted suicide, she occasionally experienced suicidal ideation, which just means that she, you know, has thoughts about what it would be like, or sometimes says, you know, I wish I didn't wake up in the morning. It's different than having a thought about actually taking one's life, God forbid. The most effective calming technique that she has developed with the guidance of a therapist involves writing down her thoughts as they are coming. Not typing them, for some that would work, but writing them. If she has these thoughts of suicide ideation on Shabbos, may she write down her thoughts. Now, at this point, again, in our discussion, or maybe even before we had our discussion, the answer would seemingly be obvious to everyone here. But if you've never had such a Shiloh, if you've ever heard such a Shiloh, then it's important, I think, that we just stop for a moment and, again, to sort of appreciate the struggles that people have. Now we're going to shift our discussion a little bit and talk a little more specifically about how the halacha may address and deal with some issues. I'm now going to formally reiterate and actually writing the disclaimer that I've sort of made already. Nothing stated or implied, well, it's this morning, should be applied as a psak, given the obvious complexities and nuances within halacha, as well as the particular and individualized needs when managing mental illness. Anyone seeking halacha guidance should seek personal counsel. So these are not discussions that we have in a very general sense, and then you walk away and say, okay, so here's what I understood from the presentation from some rabbi I never heard of, a Kol Yom Rishon, and therefore this is not what we're going to do. No, we're just here to sort of, you know, have a general conversation so people can understand and appreciate. Now, what are some halachic categories that may apply to one who is suffering from a mental disorder? If we could just talk about categories. One was mentioned already. Somebody used the term chole shegeish bo sakana. So the term chole, which means the one who is sick, in halacha, we have different categories of chole. You have a chole shegeish bo sakana, which means a person who is in a potentially life-threatening situation. Sometimes people make the mistake to think that a chole shegeish bo sakana means there's a guy who's lying on the floor, he doesn't have a pulse, and the paramedics have been working on it for 20 minutes. He may still be alive, but that's not the threshold in halacha of chole shegeish bo sakana. Chole shegeish bo sakana could actually be a person who's walking around, breathing normally, going to work, everything's fine, but his medical condition is such that he is in a state of potential danger, and therefore it has to be managed appropriately. The most common situation in which there's discussion about a person's status of chol is when it comes to Shabbos, because often there are conflicts that need to be resolved. And of course, when it comes to a chol shiyesh b'sakana, so we know that anything that has to be done in order to manage the health of this individual, to make sure that they are safe and healthy at all times, is done on Shabbos with, you know, certain caveats. We always try to minimize Chol Shabbos when we can, but that's a Chol Shiyesh B'Sakana. Any other categories or descriptions that come to mind when we talk about a Chol? Actually, I realize you have the sheets ahead, so you can even look. So we can talk about a Chol Shiyesh B'Sakana. You know, not every Chol is in a situation where such a person is in a life-threatening condition. How do we define in halacha chol she'ein bo sakana? What do you need to be called a chole if there's no sakana?
No fel de mishkav.
Right. So which basically means that a person can't function normally the way they are normally functioning. They get up in the morning, they go to work, they get themselves dressed, they eat. So whatever we do to functionally normal, when a person is nafel mishkav, which means not necessarily that they are literally, you know, bedridden, which sometimes is the case, but they can't function normally. They're in tremendous pain. They have, let's say, a migraine, a person has a high fever. So it could be if they force themselves, they can get out of bed, but they can't carry out the regular activities and duties of life in the way they normally would. That's called a chol she'ein bo sakana. We also speak, when it comes to Shabbos, about a person who suffers from what's called a mechush ba'alma, which means some lower level of discomfort, where a person is may actually have, you know, a mild flu, but it's really mild, and so therefore they can function normally, but they have some discomfort. When it comes to somebody who suffers a mental disorder, so we potentially could be discussing a topic of shote, and we know that in halacha, you know, Chazal grouped different people together in different situations. There's a famous general category in halacha that we call a cheirushat v'katan, which are three individuals, but really types of individuals, who according to halachic standards don't have das. And which basically means that they don't have either permanently or perhaps at that particular phase or stage of their life, or because of what they're dealing with at that moment, do not have the capacity to put the mental input that's necessary in order to be held responsible to fulfill mitzvahs properly, and so therefore the halacha basically relieves them, exempts them of that responsibility, and actually, because of the fact that they are exempt from the mitzvah, therefore, as we know, while they can choose to do so, they cannot perform a mitzvah that would then, let's say, be sufficient to be motzi somebody else in the mitzvah. So that's why a katan, for example, cannot recite kiddush for a gadol. It could be that the katan happens to be a very, very sincere and devoted katan. You know, it's just a couple weeks before his bar mitzvah, but he could still not recite kiddush because he has not reached that threshold in halacha which is considered a bar das, and so therefore cannot perform a mitzvah that requires das, certainly for others. When we talk about somebody who struggles with a mental disorder, they may, not necessarily, but they may from time to time or on a permanent basis be classified as a shote. Most often that is not the case. I would say in the majority of cases that we may be familiar with, because there are in fact a lot of people who struggle with different mental disorders, such individuals are not, but it's a conversation to have. You can also potentially talk about an ones, which is a term that we use to describe a situation where a person cannot carry out certain religious obligations or is perhaps, and this is a little more controversial perhaps, or is compelled to do so, is coerced to do so, or has a compulsion to do so because of circumstances that are beyond his or her control. Normally, when we speak in halacha about an ones, it's because of something which is external. Something's coming that's from the outside that is preventing me or forcing me to do something or not do something. It's a little more controversial when we talk about somebody who has forces from within, but I do believe at a certain point, if a person is really in a very debilitated state, we can certainly talk about a situation, lo aleinu, where a person is an ones. And again, here as well, I would say that in most cases, that is not so. There is a fascinating tshuva that is found in the second volume of the Minchas Asher, the tshuvas of Rav Shlomo, of Rav Asher Weiss, Shlita, who of course is a world-renowned posek, someone who is renowned for his mastery of Kol HaTorah Kula, but who has written extensively and has lectured and taught extensively when it comes to medical issues. He has been for many years now the posek of Shaar Tzedek Hospital in Yerushalayim, and it is really world renowned. Like I said, in many regards, but in this regard in particular, and he has, I think, really a revolutionary tshuva in the second volume, talking about somebody who struggles with OCD. And we're going to work a little backwards, depending on how much time we have. We may not actually discuss some of the details of the Shiloh, but what I would like to do, it's a funny way to look at a tshuva, but that's sort of my goal for this discussion this morning, is not start with the question, but I just want to share with you some additional descriptions and categories and halachic perspectives that he uses in a very, very, it's not my place to say, but what seems to me to be in a way that is reveals, again, just a mastery of Torah with a deep, deep sensitivity to mental illness and just to the human condition. And rather than limit himself in the way we just did to Cholesh Yesh Bo Sakana, Ein Bo Sakana, Ones, Istenes, so he's able to really sort of expand the entire conversation and talk about it, you know, much more globally in terms of how we address, or in this case, the specific question that he's dealing with, how we guide a person who is stuck and is trying to navigate the very, you know, difficult challenges of living a halachic, observant lifestyle while being, unfortunately, was struggling with some very acute mental disorders. So he says the following, and these are all quotes, and again, this is not the way to learn a tshuva typically, but this is, you know, this is what I'm choosing to do here today. Rishoy ha'adam levatel mitzvah saseh, He says that it is permissible for a person to be mevatel mitzvah saseh, which means to forego on the performance of a mitzvah, in order to prevent themselves from becoming sick later. Now, maybe that's obvious to everyone here, but I will only tell you, I mean, such a statement is not as obvious as it may sound. It requires stopping for a moment, just thinking and applying principles that we know. He says, the impater hu milivazveis hon rav al mitzvos. If a person is not required to spend all of their money, let's say, or even most of their money, or too much money, not to discuss the details of that right now, in order to perform mitzvos, who are then? Well, then it seems reasonable and obvious then, that a person doesn't have to become sick. Doesn't make sense that a person's money should be more valuable than their own body. We're not talking about a life-threatening situation over here, but when a person says, listen, I have a choice. I could either do this mitzvah, get sick, or not do this mitzvah and not get sick. So he says, well, it's sort of obvious. Now, in many people's experience, this sort of question doesn't normally come up. I mean, I guess what comes to my mind, because it's fresh in my mind, is would a person be required to sit in the sukkah if it's freezing cold outside and they're going to get sick? So the answer is no, but not necessarily because of this reason. They always say, you know, you're probably a mitzvah, you're part of the sukkah anyway. If you think about it, there aren't that many times where performing a mitzvah is one that would actually make a person sick. There may be shilas that come up, a person, let's say, has an allergy to wheat, or eating matzah. You know, but I mean, when you think about it, how often, typically, generally speaking, is there a real clash between one's health and the performance of a mitzvah? Not that often. But over here, when dealing with a situation where there's a person who is struggling, in this case, like I said, with OCD, and therefore it's interfering with his ability to perform a mitzvah, and the shiloh, which we'll see later, but Zesser of Weiss says, is he obligated to push himself to do the mitzvah anyway? So he says, no. But you know why? Because a person is permitted to be mevatel a mitzvah if the alternative is going to get sick. He says, "Shareim lo yisrape," because if a person does not ultimately succeed in achieving or restoring their health, v'yechlatz min ha-meitzar, and is not able to sort of free themselves from this otherwise, you know, compromised position, yivatel mitzvos ele lenetzach v'chol kagadna mina mutav shechal Shabbos achas v'lechal Shabbosos harbin. We want to help this person recover. We want to help them move forward and be able to manage their own health, in this case, mental health, better. And if we don't allow them the flexibility to do so, well, they're just going to remain in this place forever. And now he goes and he draws from another principle, which is really hard to know when you apply this. I wouldn't apply any of this in any situation, but certainly over here, there is a concept in halacha that mutav shi'chal Shabbos achas v'chal Shabbos harbin. That sometimes a person has to be mechal Shabbos once, if that will then mean that he would not, if that will prevent him from having to be mechal Shabbos many times again in the future. Again, also an interesting concept, not something that really comes up all that often. If you think most of the shilas that people have regarding Shmir Shabbos, rarely the person say, well, I have to be mechal Shabbos today, or else I'm going to have to be mechal Shabbos for the next 5 weeks. We don't usually encounter such a clash. But over here, Rav Weiss intuitively, because of, again, his mastery of Kolatura Kula and his sort of his hand on the pulse, says, well, we sort of apply that concept over here because conceptually it fits. And then he writes something which is, again, fascinating. He says, Chassam Sofer ochiach svara zu. The Chassam Sofer actually proves the svara. Mimata matzina b'mishim ha'alach b'midbar b'niyodeh b'izayom Shabbos. A person is lost in the desert and doesn't know what day it is. Yikes. So first of all, if you're lost in the desert, I mean, it's the least of your problems. You don't know what day it is, but now look, this guy's lost in the desert and he doesn't know what day it is. So what does he do? What is he supposed to do? Obviously, he's trying to find his way out of there, but he doesn't have a job, so then he can't, what, he can't do anything that would constitute a malach on Shabbos, ever? What do you think? So the halacha is, asur lasos malacha ela kedei chayev. He's prohibited from doing anything except the things that he needs to do. Not just today, but anything, because he doesn't, any day could be Shabbos. So therefore, you do what you need to do in order to stay alive, like you would, even if it would be Shabbos, but nothing else. So if he has, and again, I don't know how many malachos conceivably you can do when you're wandering in the desert, but you can do what you need to do. Avalohigbilu al shalol aleches yotzei mitchum Shabbos. However, the halacha says there's one exception to this, and that is that you are not limited of walking only to Chum Shabbos every day. Imagine telling this guy, okay, every day you could walk 2,000 amos and then you got to stop, and tomorrow you start again. The halacha doesn't say that. Rather, every day you could walk as far as your feet can take you. Why? The halo alav lasos kol mashbiyado letzeis min amidbar legiel amakim yishuv kedei lekayim mitzvos hashabbos kedasu kedin. The goal is to get out of there. If you're going to tiptoe every single day, God forbid, you may never find your way out. The halacha recognizes that and accommodates that and says we can't say that you can only walk within tchum every day, because that will undermine the entire goal, which is to find your way out of the desert and come to a place of safety. And so therefore, so Rav Weiss basically applies that svar over here as well. And he says, when there is a person who is struggling with or suffering from, in this particular case, OCD, but it could be applied to other types of mental illness as well, sometimes, you know, often, the process of treatment and recovery is one which is lengthy. It takes time. And if we're going to limit the person's ability to do what they need to do to recover in order to accommodate the halachic obligations they have along the way, they may never find their way out. And if they do, the refuah may not be as complete. It may not be as lasting. It may not be as meaningful. And so therefore, it's such a beautiful, I just think it's such a beautiful application of the din and the comparison, which is something which I just think, just on a human level, is so incredibly compelling and sensitive. That, you know, a person who is struggling with a mental illness, in halachic terms, says Rav Weiss, is really sort of like a person who's lost in the desert. And the halacha says we have to help this person get out of there. Tchum Shabbos? No. We have to help him get out. This doesn't mean that when a person is suffering from OCD, which is, generally speaking, I would say probably without exception, it's not a life-threatening disorder, that's it. Whatever he needs to do, we can do, and it can be b'chal Shabbos. No, we're not talking about him being b'chal Shabbos. I hope that's very clear. We're not saying if a person has OCD, they can be b'chal Shabbos. God forbid, that's not what we're saying over here. And by the way, I can't right now even imagine a situation where that would be necessary or warranted. Generally speaking, almost always, when a person suffers from OCD, the problems that they have in the performance of mitzvos is when it comes to the performance of mitzvos, essay that they are repeating mitzvos and doing them in an overly meticulous way and focusing on certain details that the halacha doesn't require, but that sort of clash doesn't even really happen anyway. But we're not saying that we'll do whatever is necessary in order to accommodate a person. That's not what we're saying. But at the same time, we would look a person who is struggling and say, you know, ultimately we want to help you get out of there. We want to help you get out. And then he cites another concept, which is, I would say, of everything we've mentioned till this point, The most, in some ways, I don't know what word you would describe this, but it's hard to really relate to this idea and to know what it means. And this is the kind of thing that you wouldn't typically hear, you know, your local Orthodox rabbi apply this concept in halachic terms. But Chazal do speak about an idea of avera lishma. Avera gedol lishma, he quotes Gemara Nazir, I believe it's Gemara Bava Kamma as well, and elsewhere that talks about the concept of an avera lishma. If I'm not mistaken, it's applied to Bnos Lot. The Gemara says that Bnos Lot committed an Aveir L'Shema. Of course, coming up, we'll be reading about Lot this coming week. So, the idea that a person can perform a sin, L'Shema. Now, we all know the concept of a mitzvah L'Shema. We know the concept of Tamat Torah L'Shema. What does it mean, an Aveir L'Shema? So, he says, Lo Nizbar V'Zer Geder Mesuyam. It's actually not clear what the Geder of an Aveir L'Shema is. Like, how do you define that? He says the concept of the Avera L'Shma is in a situation where there is no alternative, and he gives an example of Ya'el Ish Eschavir Hakeni Masra Aveilu Hashias Yisrael. She allowed herself to be violated by Sisra. Upashet Yefsha Ben Yenachir. She did because it was clear that there was no alternative. What, she allowed the entire Jewish people to be killed? Umimenu Lamdu Makom Shadas Berura VaHasvara Yeshar Pshuta Nosenas Yefsha Linu B'Shevi Al Taseh Koch Dreshes Peula Gedol Avera L'Shma. There are certain circumstances where, when there are no better options, when there are all no alternatives, Chadal say gedola aver l'shma. Now, again, I can't remember anybody telling anybody, okay, you can do this avera because gedola aver l'shma. You need to have, you know, big shoulders to be able to apply this. But Rav Weiss, again, very boldly, you know, and really in terms of his defining this concept, the Gedera Aveir L'Shma, as being something with makam shiafsha, there are times where, when this is essentially known to be the only effective treatment for a person who has a certain disorder, then this may be a time where we would apply the concept of gedol aver l'shma, and therefore, in the particular shayla we're talking about over here, as you'll see, it means that maybe permit or even advise a person to do something that we would normally consider to be an avera. We'll define, hopefully, with time in a moment. Oh, it's late.
Yeah. Esther also was the case. But one of the same, all those cases that were brought down were all the rabbin, for the sake of the rabbin. It wasn't for a yaki and the akidus, because they were trying to save the world. By Sisra, she was trying to save Klal Yisrael, and by Esther, also trying to save Klal Yisrael. So would he have a case where they did it, where it was...
Right. I'm not so familiar with the sugi gedol aver l'shmatayan, but correct. The examples that we've seen are ones that affected the entire nation of Klal Yisrael, and therefore, and maybe it's precisely for that reason why you don't normally hear, you know, somebody comes and asks Rebbe for as a shayla, he says, yeah, gedol aver l'shma, but again, in addition, again, it's not as if his entire case is resting on gedol, but what he's doing is he's accessing. You know, from literally for Arba Kanfus HaTorah, you know, different principles that remind us that the Torah recognizes the realities of life that we sometimes find ourselves in. So I'm now concerned about how I'm going to manage the rest of my time, because I did not plan properly. So what I wanted to do, and actually time doesn't really allow, but you have the sheets in front of you, to define a little bit what OCD is, because this is a very common disorder that people struggle with. Here it's on the board, and like you said, you have it on your sheets.
Just so you know, it's not on the sheets at all.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you mean? The sheets get cut off at which point?
Right after.
Oh, that's so strange.
Right after this.
Oh. Okay, so here's what I'm going to do. Here's what I'm going to do, Blineder. After I'm done here, I'm going to go upstairs. I'll just make more copies, because I assume people want.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So
pictures of this.
Yeah, I'll give you copies. Okay, good.
No,
don't do that. I'll make copies. It's the least we can do. You come in and learn with us, we'll make copies. Don't worry about it. I apologize. I don't know what happened. That's strange.
Some are complete.
All right, that's even stranger. I will make copies afterwards. But anyway, what I hope that people have a basic idea, a general idea about what OCD is and how it operates. What I wanted to talk about, but really I'm going to decide not to spend too much time on this right now, is a very interesting question, and that is, what is the difference between OCD and just general religious scrupulosity? There are people who we know, and maybe it includes some of us over here, just tend to be medaktikim when it comes to mitzvahs, that we want to do mitzvahs properly, and at times it's hard to really tell the difference between one who is just, again, a sincere and devoted medaktik b'mitzvos. You know, if you ever studied the Sefer Maseilas Yesharim, you know, the opening chapters, he talks about the midah of zehiros. Zehiros means that a person should be focused and diligent and mindful of what he does and what he doesn't do. And we should try to be, you know, we should be medaktik. And we should be, you know, next midah talks about midah says rizos, which sort of goes hands in hand with zehiros. So, in general, you know, the halacha encourages and promotes that we take, you know, our shmiras mitzvos seriously. And then we have, let's say, a population in the community, which is not a small population at all, that's separate from their own, very often very, very sincere and genuine interest to be, you know, Ovei Hashem, also have OCD tendencies and struggle with OCD in other areas of life. And the clash between the two and the overlap between the two is sometimes a little difficult to navigate that and to know what you're dealing with. So, for example, there are times where you see a person, one of the classic, I mean, there are numerous examples, but someone, a classic example would be, there are times where people, they daven a very, very long Shemon Esrei, they have a very long Kriya Shema, daven for a very long time. Sometimes, say often, that's driven exclusively by a person's just, you know, sincere desire to daven in the most proper way. After all, tefillah is avodah shebelev. Unfortunately, the kashas are many of us, where we just daven so quickly, very mindlessly, why don't we think about what we're saying, what we're doing. And here you have people who take the time necessary in order to daven properly. And then you may have, either within that population or a separate population of people who it's not necessarily driven by a sincere desire to serve Hashem in the most genuine way, as much as it is a concern, a deep concern that I'm not saying the words properly, and maybe I didn't have the proper kavana. And so therefore what happens is a person becomes very anxious and will repeat it again and again, and will get stuck sort of in the cycle that was, you know, that you find over here. And so therefore, I found on the OL website, I don't know who to quote because they didn't have any name over here, but certain, like sort of these scenarios which described over here, this is actually a similar situation where somebody's described over here, Yaakov, you know, from a distance, people are very amazed at the way in which he davens. But others realize that maybe something else is going on over here. Over here, it discusses Rivka, who has a lot of shadows in the kitchen when it comes to kashrus, which is another area where sometimes women, could be men as well, but more often than not, women have lots of concerns about the contamination, cross-contamination of different kelim, and something happened, and my hands were a little greasy, and I may have touched something, and I don't know what that means. Should I throw out the soup? Should I throw out the pot? Do I have to self-clean the oven? You know, so again, sometimes it's just because people just don't know and are learning, and sometimes you find, particularly with Bali Tshuva, that they're very, very concerned, they want to do everything right. But other times you have over here, in addition or instead of that, a person is really struggling with OCD. So the halacha obviously must deal with this. And there are ways, there are suggestions as to how we can differentiate between the two. And I'm skipping now a lot of slides for the purpose of time. But David Greenberg, Dr. David Greenberg, who has discussed this issue, has suggested sort of a test that we can use to identify when we're dealing with OCD as opposed to a person who's just being halakhically scrupulous. Compulsions transcend requirements of a religious law. So when a person is being is doing things above and beyond that which the halacha requires and has sought counsel and has been told that and yet continues to do that, that would be a feature of OCD likely. Compulsions have a narrow focus on one area of religious experience. And he points out earlier that it's very interesting that often people who struggle from OCD don't have many struggles when it comes to Shabbos, Hilchos Shabbos, which of course is a very important area of halacha. And of course the consequence of being mechalel Shabbos is quite severe. But when it comes to other areas of halacha, which are almost insignificant and are not, it's not even clear that they are necessarily, you know, halachic requirements, you know, very often we find that people sort of can sort of find themselves stuck in that area. So that would seem to be an indicator that what's happening over here is probably more OCD. Compulsions focus on something that is trivial to religious practice, but normal for OCD. Compulsions cause the patient to ignore or to be unable to fulfill other areas of religious law, which in general, by the way, is a feature of OCD, where a person can't, it's interfering with the ability to sort of function normally and carry out their other obligations. The patient repeats actions because of doubt where law would not require it. So take a look at the shayla that Rav Asher Weiss is discussing over here. And this is the quotes that I mentioned before and come from this tshuva. Talmud Chacham Muflag, V'yari Shemayim B'Rabim Shesov V'Mikra Kasha Shel OCD. L'Rovin M'suga L'Hagos Bracha Kihulchasa. Describes over here a very distinguished Talmud Chacham who is known to be a Yari Shemayim and really distinguished in this regard, also suffers from OCD, and very often he is not able, or he fears he's not able, to recite the bracha properly. He's not pronouncing the words properly, he's not reciting Kriya Shema properly, and he gets stuck in this pattern and he has tremendous Agmas Nefesh. I'm going to just read it in English. The doctors who have been dealing with him and who address this issue in general say that the best way for such a person to address this problem and to ultimately be able to succeed in treating it is by not repeating what they've said at all. You say it once and then you move on. And don't allow yourself to repeat it. You just have to fight that urge and not to repeat it. And over time, through exposure again and again to this type of behavior, so it hopefully will help a person, in addition perhaps to other prevention, overcoming this struggle. So he comes with the shaila. He says, I am positive, there may be situations where I am positive that I did not recite the bracha properly. I did not recite the Shem Hashem properly. Can I eat the food? Can I eat it? I'm positive. And if you're going to tell me it's mutter, maybe I shouldn't eat bread. Because at least this way, I can avoid a situation where I'm going to have to recite because I'm Mazon, Shechiv Ben HaTorah, it's not just one bracha of Atala, maybe multiple brachas of Atala. So maybe I should just avoid eating bread when I find myself in this situation. Right? So question number one is, if I know that I didn't recite the bracha properly, what do I do? And maybe for the time being, I should just avoid eating bread. And forget Shabbos. Just in general, a lot of people don't eat bread for a whole variety of reasons. Maybe, I'll just forego on eating bread. And, right, so he says, Nira, the ein lo l'hakbid v'kach klal, a person should not be makbid, u'minatam shekvar nisbar leo, for the reasons we mentioned. She'rezativ ha'muhusa shemach lezu, this is the nature of this illness, she'adam yaser es atzmo kol hazman, b'charedush lo osa samuto lo lovel yotzi dechavosa b'shum dover. A person sort of feels tortured by this thought that I didn't do it properly. And only when you overcome that concern from inside will you ultimately be able to be mishtachrer, to free yourself from this burden of this disorder. And he says, in this paskadei, when you tell a person not to eat bread or not to eat a certain amount of bread, yimse elav she'elos nasaf, is going to have thousands of other questions. Maybe I ate too much. Maybe now I do have to bench, even though I didn't. He says that's not the way to address it. The way to address it is to live, he basically says, a normal life, doing what you would normally do, while at the same time following the advice of the doctors, which are saying don't repeat, and that's it. He says, "Mishum kein near a bar lemaisa de yishul inag chol adam kedarka shel olam yishtadel pamachas bekiyum mitzvosav kamavur." You try to do the mitzvah once, and you accept it, and you sort of move on. Easier said than done. I personally don't struggle for most of these. I don't want to make it sound like any of this is easy, and what's the big deal? To the contrary, I mean, it can be for many people a real, real struggle. But what an incredible tshuva. Now again, Rabbi is certainly not the first one in the history of tshuvas of this nature to speak about this. In fact, he actually quotes a in this case that comes from the Sefer Isos V'Adrachos, but it's also found in other Svarim, the Stipler Gaon. Years ago, the Stipler died, I think at the end of maybe 1979, early 1980s.
86.
Okay, good. So, I mean, long before, I'm going to say long before, we spoke about OCD then as well, but I think there have been major progress in the world of science in general, medicine in particular, and mental health even more so. The vocabulary that exists, the sensitivity, the awareness, among everybody, even in the medical community, and especially for the purpose of the discussion within the halachic community among poskim, so a lot's happened. The Stipler, my guess, is long before he had access to the professional resources that Rav Asher Weiss does, intuitively came to the very same conclusions, and Rav Weiss quotes the Stipler in this regard, and basically, in this case, is giving direction to the Shah is dealing with over here is a woman whose husband is making her crazy when it comes to management of her own Taras Mishpacha, responsibilities. So when it comes to, let's say, Shadu B'diga, and her husband wants to see it, I don't think it's a problem, and basically he is slowing down the process considerably and second guessing and third. So the Stipler basically tells him, you just got to step aside. This has nothing to do with you. Well, obviously it does, but it basically he says, is this is the woman's responsibility, it's hers, and you should just, you can't get caught up in this. And he says, and this is, I think, often what doctors will say, the person asks a shayla, the rub, the posek, with a certain amount of sensitivity, I'm not going to answer that question. It's not going to be helpful for me to answer that question for you, or you answer once and that's it. I've found myself in situations like this where Dr. Abraham Torskov is quoting, an OCD sufferer may not necessarily be reassured by the opinion of poskim. One woman with OCD threw out three sets of dishes because she cannot accept the Rav's ruling that the dishes were perfectly kosher, saying the Rav did not understand my shayla. I've had this situation on numerous occasions. Not always OCD. Sometimes, often when people have shaylas in the kitchen, it's about something, the cross-contamination, basav v'chalav, and the question about the food and the pot, and sometimes, let's say, the stove or the oven, whatever the case may be. So often, in certain situations, the din is that the food is okay, but you have to kasher the pot. A lot of people they're just not comfortable with that. So no, I'm not going to eat the food. I throw it out. But you don't have to. It's fine. If the pot was not a ben yomo, you could eat it. Nope. So this is not all that uncommon. But when you have a person with certain OCD tendencies, may repeatedly ask questions where really there is no question at a certain point. And in my experience, when people feel that you understand where they are and you're trying to assist them, they do, in fact, receive this well rather than being turned off. You say, I'm not going to answer that question. Do you have any other questions? And actually sort of appreciate that sort of support. Okay. Whew. Okay, I know I was told, between 45 and 60 minutes. I took us 55. Any questions or comments or thoughts? I'm going to make more sheets. There is so much more to say on this. I ran through a lot of them. Just to reiterate, the goal over here was not to come to any firm, hard conclusions in any particular specific case, more to just present an overview to help us understand and to appreciate
Number one, and we don't really speak so much about this, but you'll trust me, the prevalence of mental illness of all different forms, the range of different disorders that people have and struggle with, and the extent to which the halacha sort of recognizes, has the vocabulary and the means to deal with these situations. I tried to give you sort of a sampling of some of the questions that people ask, but I'm sorry, there are literally hundreds and thousands of others. And in my experience, again, I sort of have, I like many people, you know, you sort of select the poskim that you ask shailos to. But in my experience, you know, the poskim that I've turned to for personal guidance and for guidance on behalf of others have been exceedingly, not just sensitive, which goes without saying, but informed and really, really understand and appreciate. And when they don't, they'll say, I have to call my therapist, I have to call my, you know, my expert in this area, and to understand more about the particulars, and then I can give you an informed psak. And that's, I think that's an amazing thing. And as always, it's important for people to ask shailas and make no assumptions about what the halacha will not permit and advise in situations where there's conflict between one's health, be it physical health and mental health, and halacha. Yes?
How about mash for ruach? Isn't that each of them the same over and over until you create a new habit? That's what I've heard.
That is, well, again, so... So, Mashiv Ruach Moreh Geshem, when we make that change in the davening, there's a question that if a person doesn't know if he said Mashiv, let's say I daven, I don't remember, so I don't know what I did. So, the halacha basically says that you assume what you've done what you're used to doing, which makes perfect sense. So, and basically, the cutoff is 30 days. Whether it's 30 days, or 90 tefillos, or 91 tefillos, but or 100 tefillos, the question. But basically, for the first, let's say, 30 days, you assume that you did what you're accustomed to doing. So some Rishonim say, it's Machlokas, the Torah brings down a Machlokas between Rabbeinu Peretz and Rami Rutenberg, whether or not you can condition yourself in a shorter period of time, where I'm going to say, Machayim Eisem HaTorah V'Hoshia Mashiv Ruach Moreh Geshem, say it again, again, again. And this way, if I don't know, I can assume that I've restrained myself. So if I understand your question, what you may be asking is, if a person is already, you know, struggling with certain areas like we've discussed, like OCD, is that the kind of exercise that may knock them off balance? And the answer is perhaps. I don't know. Maybe. That's an interesting shiloh. Well, you know, my guess is that such an individual may anyway have great struggles when we make these changes in davening, because even a person doesn't necessarily struggle in this area sometimes. I felt bad. There was a guy actually... He came to me yesterday. I offered to stand with him the third time. He forgot it twice. I just wanted to say, I have to repeat it the third time. I said, I'll stand with you. I mean, I felt bad. He's just it happens. People forget.
Say more at all.
Okay, that may be a good solution. You say more at all, so you never have to go back, because but the Yevet, that's also good. Yeah. Any other questions, comments? Yes.
I'd like to say that Rabbi Dr. Abraham Tursky, whom I've known forever, is a board-certified psychiatrist who had a Lincoln Rehabilitation Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where the shooting occurred last year at this particular time. He always has the Derech Eretz, regardless of what he knows, for his patients who are applicable, to consult the place. Okay, because a Jew never compromises his religious integrity. There's a lot to say here. Essentially speaking, I'd have to make an appointment with you privately. Time does not permit.
Sure.
To discuss these things.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much. So thank you so much for your participation. Blineder, I will bring down sheets. Just by show of hands, so I don't make more than I need to. How many people need a new set of sheets? Okay. So I'll make about 7. Very good. Thank you. And Hatzlacha. I'll turn the lights back on.
All right. Thank you very much, Rabbi Rothwax. We're going to take a brief 10-minute intermission, followed by Rabbi Ziering's shiur.